So have you heard of Whamageddon?
No. What is Whamageddon?
I love how you had a moment of like, that's a thing Lauren made up, but it's not. Whamageddon is this quote fingers game where if you can get to Christmas and you haven't heard Wham's Last Christmas, then you win.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just keep that in mind because this episode comes out on Christmas Day and you may or may not be a winner of Whamageddon at that point.
Yeah, I'll have to check in with you and let you know.
Please do.
So happy holidays, threadlings.
Happy holidizzles.
I feel like we always have something to say beforehand, but I'm just going to pop in now.
Okay, all right.
Now.
Okay.
So welcome to Check Your Threading. This is a bi-weekly podcast where we watch a movie or film, depending.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
We do a little research, and then we come over here and we talk about the history, context, and philosophy of that film.
That is so true.
Or movie, depending.
Yeah.
I'm Bonnie. I have a film theory background. I don't have anything else to say.
I mean, you know, it's bound to happen eventually. Eyelash haver, glasses wearer.
Oh my gosh.
Air breather.
Bonnie B.
Yeah. And I'm Lauren, and I have a background in creative writing, and I'm just so gosh diddly dang excited that we're going to talk about religious stuff today.
Happy birthday, Jesus.
Yeah. Actually, so. Pushes glasses up nose.
When is his birthday?
I don't know. Not December. But
it's probably in July. So Christmas in July makes more sense
than
Christmas in December.
Yeah. It's the kind of thing where it's like, I know enough. I want to be sassy enough about religion to know that he wasn't born on December 25th, but I don't care enough to educate myself as to what day it actually is.
I hear you.
So
I hear you.
That's how I feel.
She's also salty because her birthday is in December and she's had to share it with Jesus since she was born.
I'm extremely, basically. Extremely salty about Sagittarius season being crammed into... Actually, I guess Jesus is a Capricorn.
Yeah.
But still, the Sagittarians are the ones who are predominantly affected by the double gifting scenario.
Well, and here's my thing. You gotta be freaking joking if you think a Capricorn is gonna sacrifice himself for everybody else's sins. Oh. I'm sorry.
That's why he wasn't born in December.
Legit.
So, in case you forgot, we're watching The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yes. So, The Last Temptation of Christ is a 1988 epic drama directed by Martin Scorsese. It's written by Paul Schrader. This film is an adaptation of Nikos Kazantzakis' controversial 1955 novel of the same name. The film, starring Willem Dafoe... Not William, it's Willem.
It's Willem.
Harvey Keitel, Barbara Hershey, and Andre Gregory, as well as Harry Dean Stanton and David Bowie, was shot entirely in Morocco. So that's what I got.
All right, just some casual David Bowie in there at the end.
Yeah, very strange.
All right. So this movie came out in 1988, right? Did you say that?
Yes.
Okay. So to set the scene for religious movies in the 80s, I was going to talk a little bit about, you know, religion in the 80s, specifically Christianity.
Fun.
Yeah. So to set the scene, we sort of hit a fever pitch in what I'm going to call public Christendom in the 80s, which is a combination of things. It's the rise of TV evangelists, the proliferation of the Christian right in helping Ronald Reagan get elected in 1980.
What is happening?
Bonnie has a lot of feelings about Ronald Reagan.
I do.
And, you know, while you can argue that religion has played some role in probably every election in the United States ever, Reagan's 1980 campaign is the first time that religious leaders had an audience on TV that, You know, they could get together and get organized in this really intense way and say to their followers, like, hey, you should vote for this guy because we're under attack.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So part of this is a response to my favorite subject, communism.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So the state-endorsed atheism that happens in communist countries is, like, got everybody all concerned. So U.S. church leaders are afraid that kind of atheism would take root in the U.S. And religion has always been seen as, like, a tonic against communism.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And then there's also the whole thing about how the U.S. countercultural movement of the 1960s to 1980s led to a backlash from the Christian community. So because of all the, like, free love and hippy-dippy stuff, we also had, you know, Christians fighting Roe vs. Wade, a clampdown on sex education in public schools, a huge anti-homosexuality law push. So things like that. This was also when prayer in school reared back up as a huge issue, and whether or not we wanted to teach evolution versus creationism.
I remember being in school when some of this stuff was finally starting to wind down.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine it when it was at its fever pitch, you know?
Well, and it's funny because it's one of those things that, like, I didn't really think about it until I was reading it on the page, but the whole concept of whether we should be teaching evolution or creationism in public schools was settled in the 1920s. So Scopes Monkey Trial, one of our favorite episodes of Drunk History.
Yes, totally.
I think it was like 1925. God. So the fact that it comes back again 60 years later, it's like, okay, the Christian right really likes to recycle issues to keep everyone distracted.
Yeah.
So simultaneously to all that happening politically, we're also getting into a new age of evangelical preachers on TV. Hooray, question mark.
this is one of my favorite topics of discussion.
Yeah, this is Bonnie's youth is clashing up against my youth in this episode.
Yeah, yeah.
So Pat Robinson is our first big evangelical preacher. He even runs for president in 1988.
What?
Yeah. The Moral Majority was a political party run by Jerry Falwell that started in 1979 and went almost through the end of the 80s. And I only bring up the political part of this to explain, like, what a huge audience these guys had. Because you can't just, like, casually run for president. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
And then simultaneously, there are three really big evangelists. Jim Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, and Peter Popoff, who have huge scandals. So we have intense visibility into Christian personalities and huge scandals attached to them. So Baker got accused of sexual misconduct and went to jail for embezzlement in 1987. Swaggart was caught with a prostitute in 1988 and got defrocked, and then got caught with another prostitute in 1991. I know, right? Popoff was a faith healer and used personal details directly from God to convince his followers that he was blessed, but in 1986 it came out that he was using a radio device to talk to his wife to get all this information and wasn't curing people at all. He also got caught saying racial slurs and sexually explicit stuff on tape, which is generally a bad look for people pretending to be the voice of the Lord.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So the Christian community by the late 80s, when this movie comes out, is kind of in a froth.
What?
Yeah, come on. Just a little prone to frothiness. they've been told by their political leaders that they're being attacked by communists. They are fighting to get their agenda pushed in public schools. And evangelical leaders are going belly up across the nation. And it's fucking embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. I'd say so.
Yeah. I think it's embarrassing, but for a different reason than they probably thought it was embarrassing. Okay, so now I'm going to take a sharp right turn, like that exit ramp meme.
Yes.
And talk about Jungian psychology.
Woo!
Which Bonnie loves. So a lot of the themes that are covered in The Last Temptation of Christ follow some pretty intense Jungian tent poles, which is funny because a lot of people focus on Freud when they cover this movie. But here's some Carl Jung for dummies, some super high level highlights of his psychology.
Get it, girl.
Okay, so basically Jungian psychology talks about the concept of duality, which is great when you're talking about Jesus and God and the duality of a spiritual entity inhabiting two separate spaces. Mm-hmm. Assuming that God even has a space to inhabit. That's a road I'm not going to go down. so anyway, Jung has some pretty cool thoughts about duality, one of which is his concept of the shadow self.
My favorite.
Yeah. So the shadow is the idea that for all of our dominant positive character traits, there are also negative ones that we would rather not look at. So in Jung's mind, any life without a shadow self or awareness of the shadow self can lead to some pretty shallow, vapid personalities. So you need this darkness to understand yourself. It's like it's part of the whole. So the shadow is your dark side, but the shadow isn't evil. Jung talks about light and dark, but the dark elements are just another necessary part of our lives. They are custom tailored to our personalities. And I mention that because another aspect of Jung's psychology, which was pretty unique and revolutionary when he first published about it, was the idea of the collective unconscious. So the collective unconscious is the idea that we're all born with blueprints inside of us to act a certain way.
Yes.
And this is something that most progressive thinking medical doctors and therapists believe today for actual measurable scientific reasons.
Generational trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And being born homosexual or transgender are the obvious modern debates that we talk about when we talk about born this way. But Jung believed that this could play all the way down to, like, are you an analytical person? Are you creative? Are you introverted or extroverted? Like you said, do you have generational trauma that you inherited from, you know, fill in the blank? So pretty much any major character trait could be tied to the collective unconscious. And he called these preset personality types archetypes, which is not something that has been as embraced by the scientific community. Sorry, Carl. So you hear archetype language used a lot more in literary study and in pseudosciences like astrology or tarot cards. Sort of the same way even tarot cards can have like a shadow reading where the same card can have, you know, a positive or a negative outcome depending on how you play it. So the reason for the archetypes is sort of a chicken or the egg situation. Jung named his archetypes after a lot of things that we see in literature, like the hero, the villain, the maiden, the trickster, etc. Because of the idea that these personalities are so overarching, they're built into us from birth, hence the collective part of the collective unconscious. And we see these archetypes play out in Bible stories, including The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yes.
I know that you want to talk to us about other Bible stories, so I thought I would just slide it on over to you.
Slide it on over.
Yeah.
I'm not drunk.
You're drunk on Jesus.
So in that same vein as archetypes, I want to talk about what makes an epic film epic. Like, what are the staples of an epic film?
But not like, that movie was epic.
Right. Not like surfer epic.
Okay.
When I say epic, what I'm talking about are films that are usually based on a historical event of some kind. And then, like, throw in a dash of 2 hour plus runtime, a cup of elaborate costumes, a spoonful of on location settings, and just, like, pour on a huge cast of not only, like, extras, but also, like, all-star characters.
Sure.
So, like, your actors have to be name-recognized. And then music that makes you feel things.
Okay.
And that's what an epic is.
Okay.
So, mainstream Hollywood loved from the silent era on. But you know who got to the epic first?
Jesus? Is it Jesus?
Italians.
Oh, I love it when it's Italians. Okay.
So in 1913, the Italian film industry released Quo Vadis, which was directed by Enrico Guasconi. It's the story of Emperor Nero's tyranny and can be fully set into the epic genre due to its 2 hour runtime, elaborate sets, and its cast of 5,000 plus extras.
Holy shit. Okay.
Yeah.
This is like some Battle of Mordor shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
So the epic genre is often synonymous with Bible stories as far as the history of film and the Hollywood system. So mainstream cinema was all about Bible epics for a while.
So can I ask, is that because you could go to the studios and be like, people will come to this because it's about the Bible, like, we know we're gonna get the budget back?
So I don't honestly know why people chose the Bible. I always thought it was just because of belief systems. And at the time, like, literally everyone was Catholic, you know. I mean, not literally everyone, but so many people were Catholic and they were like, let's use the Bible, you know.
Yeah.
Totally makes sense. It's the only book I've ever read.
Oh, no.
So the other aspect is that mainstream Hollywood had the cash to make the Bible epic. So, you know, they pumped him out for years.
Okay.
So I'm only going to mention two big players in classic Hollywood epic cinema. They're D.W. Griffith and Cecil B. DeMille. So D.W. Griffith was considered a pioneer of cinema. He established what I would call cinematic grammar with his techniques, such as cutaways, close-up shots, cross-cutting, eyeline matches, and fade outs, just to name a few.
Wow, that's some pretty basic stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So his most famous film is a 3-hour long epic called Birth of a Nation, which came out in 1915.
Right. That's not about the Bible.
So if you don't know this movie, it's lauded as one of the most influential films of all time. And it's just pure racist garbage.
Mm-hmm.
It's a stain on cinematic history.
Yeah. Don't watch it. Just read about it.
Yeah. That's definitely. Or if you have to watch it, just watch clips, you know?
Yeah, like, there you go. It's probably in the Creative Commons by now, right? Like, nobody's making money on that.
I hope not. So Cecil B. DeMille is the second, and he's considered one of the founding fathers of Hollywood. When talking pictures became a thing, he helped invent the boom mic and the soundproof camera blimp, which basically helped reduce the shutter noise inside the camera so that you wouldn't catch it on the mic.
I'm sorry, that's just a lot funnier sounding than it probably the soundproof camera blimp. Yeah. You just said it so casually, like, yeah, you know. Okay. Very serious business filmmaking.
Okay, so he's famous for his large-scale religious films, like The Ten Commandments, Samson and Delilah, and King of Kings. I'm pretty sure he made those in the silent film era and then remade them when there was sound.
That's fair game. That's fair game. Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
We gotta add all this other stuff now. Nobody's gonna see those other ones.
Exactly. Exactly. I was reading excerpts from this text on Epic Films by Derek Ellie, and a few things he said really stood out to me about Bible epics.
Okay.
So most of these films portray Jesus.
Jesus
Christ. Jeezy crazy. Merry Jesus.
Oh my God. Happy Christmas.
Merry Chrysler. So most of these films portray Jesus in a way that mirrors his traditional representation, which in his words means a passive instrument of destiny seen in pious terms.
Hmm.
So Jesus, though he is a man, rarely reacts with emotion of any kind like a man would. He's not really a person. He's just kind of a vessel. And the events of his life play out in a series of, like, flat and lifeless events. Because, you know, we aren't on the edge of our seats wondering what the heck is going to happen to Jesus, because we already know.
Yeah, yeah.
And another thing is that filmmakers take from the Gospels as their only source material when it comes to the story of Jesus. And they never stray from it. Because that would be blasphemous and immoral, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No editorializing. Come on.
Yeah. So basically, the life of Jesus as a narrative is as played out as any Avenger movie.
Oh, you went there.
I did.
But there's not a 37-year gap in the middle of the Avengers franchise.
Not yet.
It's not 37. How many years of Jesus's life did we lose?
I think it's 16 years or something like that.
Okay, cool.
Between 12 and 16 years.
They just montage that part in the Avengers.
They just okay, all I thought was Jesus montaging with like a sweatband around his head and he's doing the like wet hot American summer like
yes
dancing.
That's what I mean.
Okay. With, like, Judas and Paul or whatever right next to him.
Yeah, and a belly shirt. I'm glad we went there.
Jean shorts.
Jesus is a never nude.
Okay. Anyway, it's formulaic, is all I'm trying to say.
Indeed.
So what was it about The Last Temptation of Christ that made people so angry?
What indeed?
Right. So I guess this brings us to Martin Scorsese, this man who was once just like this little asthmatic film-loving Catholic boy who really wanted to make a movie about Jesus, okay?
That's all he wants.
So the film wasn't even finished before religious organizations started to, like, oppose it.
Okay.
They, like, fought him all the way through production, even through the script process, through production and into the box office. And ultimately, because... like, for instance, in France, people, like, rushed into the theater and, like, started punching people turned into a nasty fight. I think there were people stabbing people.
Holy shit.
So, like, this idea of, like, violence usually draws a crowd. Like, why is everybody being so crazy about this movie?
Oh, yeah.
Well, literally people are being stabbed in the theater for going to see this movie. So, ultimately, the movie flopped.
Okay.
In the box office.
Not something you want to go and be like, let's find out if it happens in our theater.
Exactly. So I think the whole idea behind Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ was to portray Jesus as a flawed human, not as the divine.
Sure.
This version of Jesus made choices and he made mistakes, sometimes big ones. Or he gave in to his own human needs and desires, which basically would turn him into nothing more than a man rather than a deity. The Christian right was super pissed about the fact that he had sex with Magdalene.
Oh, no.
Whether that be real or imagined. And this idea that, like, he was in love with her and, you know, rescued her from the stones being thrown instead of that just being a pious act.
Oh, okay. Okay. He can love her, but he can't love her.
Right. Okay. Yes. So I also think that there is a second prong to the outrage, which is that when you go into a movie about Jesus, you expect certain things.
Mm-hmm.
You expect exactly what I mentioned before, which is vessel of God, dressed in white robes, giant sets, emotional orchestra music.
Yeah.
And an all-star cast.
Right.
Like,
right.
Robert Downey Jr. has to be Jesus, you know?
Okay. All right.
But that's not what we see. Everyone, including Jesus, were sticky, dirty, rumpled, gross. There were no white robes, or if they were white, they were stained. The lighting on his face was not holy and reverent like you see in movies back in, like, the classic Hollywood days, which in turn made Jesus look like just another guy.
Oh my God.
And, like, for fuck's sake... the movie introduces him as a dude who's, like, making crosses for the Romans in hopes that God will hate him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, zealously,
yeah.
You know?
We start out with some interesting conflict with this guy.
Then he also, he goes from love one another, peace, harmony, to let's pick up this fucking axe and slit some throats. You know, it's like. Jeez.
Jesus is mad.
Jeezy crazy. Jeezy.
Yeah, exactly.
So the score was done by Peter Gabriel, and it was eerie and sometimes uncomfortable. And I think that's exactly the kind of tone we want to set for a film where we explore the fact that Jesus had self-doubt, disturbing visions, and resentment for a father who barely spoke to him at all. And wouldn't let him live out his days with a family.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, unfortunately, I don't really have a ramp down from that.
I just want to say that I think that it's crazy that Christians were mad that he slept with Mary Magdalene, that which was, like, part of a, like, Satan-induced temptation fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing, right? Is if you really look at it, he's being tempted.
Right.
And we talk about how he was tempted all the time. Tempted in the garden, tempted in the desert, you know? This isn't his first temptation. This is his last temptation.
Right.
You know?
Oh, my God.
So, there you go.
Yeah. So I kind of feel like maybe some people didn't do some reading comprehension.
Right.
Happening here.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
And though it did flop in the box office, it went on to become a Criterion classic. It is like one of the most sold in the Criterion collection.
It also certainly didn't ruin anybody's career, which kind of amazes me. Like Willem Dafoe didn't have any kind of backlash from this. Scorsese obviously went on to yell about the Avengers. So
did he?
Oh, yeah. I'll fill you in on this later. So
cool. All right.
I know that a big part of what Christians struggled with this movie was the fact that Jesus was questioning things.
Oh, yes.
So I thought that maybe we should question some things with each other.
Yeah, let's do that.
In question time.
Good job.
Okay, thank you.
Good transition.
So question time is where we ask each other questions that the other person has not had time to prepare for. Bonnie.
Yes.
What is your favorite deadly sin?
Well, I guess my favorite
for doing.
Yeah. Okay, I guess my favorite is lust.
Okay, I guess it's kind of obvious.
I do enjoy the act of fornication.
Sure, but what's your second favorite?
Well, I don't really, outside of lust, I guess it would have to be gluttony because I love food.
Hell yeah.
I don't like sloth, but I feel like I do it a lot.
You're good at it?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because really I'm not. I'm busy all the time, but I'm sitting down when I'm busy.
Oh, so. Sure. Only you would consider sitting to be slothful while you're literally multitasking like four other things. So I guess we're illustrating a point here.
Yeah.
So, all right. Good answer.
Thank you. So my question for you is, if you had to give Jesus a hairstyle, what hairstyle would you give him? Your face right now.
That's pretty amazing. Okay, well, so I have to say, I have never really understood why Jesus had long hair, because living in the desert, working as a carpenter, just kind of seems like a not comfortable life hazard.
Like he would have a man bun.
Yeah, either.
Why is it down all the time?
Yeah, like pull it back if it's going to be long, or like get it out of your face or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's any like not ready for marriage / already married symbolism happening like women had with their hair.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Jesus should flip the script and go long in front and really pompadour it up. I think that would be pretty awesome. Because he also, like, it's not like he's washing it every day, you know? So he could really get some height happening. He wouldn't need a lot of products, just like sweat and carpenter dust and a teasing comb, and he'd be good to go.
Totally, yeah.
Or some oils that they're always talking about in the Bible, which could mean like 900 different things. So, yeah.
There were quote fingers.
Oils. That's right.
Okay.
Fashionable Jesus. So, are we going to take away?
I guess the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
Wow. High five.
Boom. So, I guess we need to head into takeaways.
Yeah,
now.
I guess we should.
Okay. So, my takeaways. This is not a very popular opinion with some of my peers, but just because a film is considered influential and groundbreaking or prolific in some way does not mean that it gets to go up on a pedestal where no one can touch it or demean it. So Birth of a Nation is a fucking garbage heap piece of shit, and I don't care how prolific it is. It helped us with grammar. It helped us with film as it is today, but somebody else would have done that if not for him, you know?
I want to know which of your friends is defending Birth of a Nation so I can, like, put them up on a stool and then push them off.
I said peers, not friends.
Oh, peers. Okay.
Peers.
That's an important distinction. Okay.
Other than that, I have a couple more Jesus stories that I think you should watch.
Okay.
The first is La Voie Lactée, which is the Milky Way by Louis Buñuel, La Montaña Sagrada, which is the Holy Mountain by Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Bonnie made me watch the Holy Mountain, and if I had to watch it, everyone else should watch it. It's an experience.
Life of Brian by Monty Python.
Yay!
Jesus Camp by Rachel Grady and Heidi Ewing. And then Simón del Desierto, Simon of the Desert by Louis Buñuel.
I've also seen that one. I'm amazed at how many of these I've seen. I get like a stamp card for Jesus movies. All right, nice.
So those are my takeaways.
Okay. So my takeaway is just a little leftover part of the Jung conversation. So something that I thought was interesting is that Jung allows for religious influence in his interpretation of how a personality comes together. But the very idea of the collective unconscious is an anti-Christian concept. So Christians or Catholics believe that every person is born tabula rasa, blank slate, free from sin and totally innocent. Unless you, I think there's like a branch of like crazy Baptists, maybe? Question mark. Yeah. I'm sorry if you're Baptist. I didn't mean to imply that you're crazy. But people who believe that like babies are like immediately like full of sin. Anyway, most Catholics believe that people are born tabula rasa. So Jung introducing the idea of a blueprint and a set state of actions that you're going to follow through is inherently sinful. And I think that there's some debate around whether or not Jesus might be a good example of evidence for the collective unconscious, because even like as a Bible story himself, Jesus has like a destiny. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's part of his story, is that he's going to be the Son of God and the Savior of mankind. He just has to follow a series of steps that will unlock a fate like the ultimate teenage heroine of a YA dystopian novel. So I just like there's no conclusion there because obviously this is still something people are fighting about. But I think that it's really interesting that, you know, the original author of this book or Scorsese as a director decided to take the idea of the collective unconscious as a super unchristian thing and apply it to like the most Christian character that you can come up with. Who is equally so well known by like every person, regardless of religion, he is in and of himself an archetype.
Yeah.
So it just like goes in circles. And I just find that like fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Thank you for that. That's so good.
You're welcome. So that's our Jesus show.
Jeezy crazy. Go. You want to get some more out?
Some Jiminy Kringles.
Jiminy Creaminies.
Jabberwocky Krongletown. JC.
Jedi Crinklin Miss.
This is like the unscripted Rick and Morty interstellar cable or whatever. Ready to Jan, Michael, your Vincent's all Christmas long.
Ready to Jan, Michael, your Christmas.
Yes. All Jesus long.
All right. Well, you know what they say about Christmas, Lauren?
What do they say about Christmas?
Christmas is a time for giving. So that's why I want our listeners to rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast for us this Christmas. That will be our Christmas present.
That would be amazing. Thanks for all the review presents. I can't wait to open them.
Oh my gosh. And be like, oh my gosh, this one's from Riley.
Oh my gosh.
This one's from really little like Susie.
Us. Oh my god. I didn't get you anything.
That's okay. I didn't get you anything either.
Yeah. I was talking to little Susie. I got you stuff.
Oh. Well, I got you stuff too.
Yeah. Nice save.
Anyway, take us away, Lauren.
Okay.
Get us out of here.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe. Footnotes for every episode are available at checkyourthreading.com. And you can find us on Twitter at checkthreading or Instagram at checkyourthreading. You can also email your New Year's resolutions and why you got in trouble at Sunday school to checkyourthreadingpod@gmail.com.
If you're interested in supporting this podcast with cash money, we can be found on Patreon at Check Your Threading. Bonus episodes can now be subscribed to on a per creation basis.
Hooray!
Jingle, jangle, jingle, jingle, jangle, jing.
Jing-a-da-jing-a-da-jing-jing-jing-jing-jing-a-da-jing-a-da-jing-jing-jing-jing-jing-jing-jing-jing-jing-jing.
That's the rest of Check Your Threading.
Everybody go have a Merry Christmas, and no matter what religion you are, go watch Mark Kanamura's Christmas dances on Instagram, because they make me super happy.
Yes. We will link them in our website.
Yeah, we will.
Bye.
Jing, jing, jing.